globalization, you know, has become a key topic. Now, globalization is not an entirely new term, although it has some new wrinkles. It comes out of, in a neutral sense, globalization simply refers to international trade and international money movements. But that's abstracting from what goes along with globalization. Because since products go through a market, we have to look at how power is connected to these movements of commodities or capital crossing boundaries. The reason I say it is not a completely new subject is that if we go back to the dawn of capitalism, which is, let's say, roughly 1500 or so, it was a period known as mercantilism. It was the beginnings of the nation state in Europe. Now, why do I mention it in connection with globalization? Because this was a kind of state capitalism in which the leaders of the country determined all sorts of rules of the game. They set prices. They set wages. They had protective tariffs. They wanted to have what was called a favorable balance of trade. In other words, to sell more than they bought, because then gold would come in, and this was thought of as helping the development of the society. Now, one connection that followed from that is that there was a race for colonies. It's like the beginnings of what you might call imperialism, or foreign trade if you want something more neutral. Anyway, it was an effort to spread power and influence beyond the boundaries. And in fact, as you know, we were a colony of England. And the function of America, as far as the British were concerned, was to enrich the wealth of the mother country. And so you had a wave of attempts at forming colonies, not just England, but many other countries. And this involved the use of economic power. And you can see this with the colonies that were formed here and the arrival eventually of huge hordes of people pushing the Indians off the land, bringing in Africans who within a century became slaves, all in the name of what was then economic progress. But it's a term we still use now. Now, these protective tariffs continued, and mercantilism continued for several centuries. And it aided the thrust of England towards economic development. But by the 1700s, it became unnecessary. And the new message was free trade. And Adam Smith was the voice of that group. And one of the reasons was that the mercantile regulations, all these subsidies and tariffs, were interfering with the newly developing capitalist class, the traders, the people that had to evade laws, because one of the regulations led to favorites of the crown being given monopoly privileges, like the English East India Company, the one whose tea we threw in Boston Harbor. Adam Smith was a voice for those that were evading these regulations. And what he was essentially saying is, if you grab for what you want and I grab for what I want, that competitive process will lead to a much more efficient allocation of resources than a state planner could possibly do. And in the process, with economic development, he thought that class conflict would be softened. And this was followed by another man named Ricardo that developed the same rationale. It's like the grandfather of globalization today. He developed the notion known as comparative advantage. And what it meant was, in theory, that each country would specialize in the production and export of those products that it had the greatest advantage in producing, where its costs were less. And the other country would do the same. The theory was, and again you hear it repeated today, that this would be good for everybody. It would be more efficient, and out of the greater efficiency would come greater production, more growth, and even greater equity than existed before. This was connected, in my mind at least, with the gradual transition of America from a competitive capitalist form to a monopolistic form. Now, earlier, that is, before the 1860s, we also had slavery, and that's unique. And a full discussion of that would take us too far askew. Although I will mention in passing that it was slave-produced cotton that was the main export that provided the surplus for economic development. And so slavery aided the development of capitalism in America, but the region itself paid a price in the sense that it became a monoculture, like many undeveloped countries. And in the war that it created to defend its the interest of their ruling class in slavery, they were obviously beaten by a section of the country that had a far better mix of agriculture and industry. In any case, what I'm leading to is the way orthodox economists look at this phenomena known as globalization. Right? So the basic part, as I said, comes from Smith and Ricardo, this notion of comparative advantage. What the economists say is that this is for the good of the nation. And if all countries participate in that, you will have a more peaceful and efficient world. Why? Because war, interesting slip. Because you're making the most effective use of each country is making the most effective use of its resources. Each becomes dependent on the other. And what's lacking from this, of course, is the notion of who really gains from the process. What about classes? So you can talk about gains and losses in terms of the nation, you know, that the nation gains out of such and such a a strategy. But what about within the nation? Did all classes gain? And what about the relationship between powerful nations and weaker nations? Well, the line that's being peddled today, and you can see from this week's confrontation of Bush and Chavez, that America is still pushing the Ricardian line that the best thing in the world for the undeveloped world is to join together. And if they did that, then they would benefit at least in growth terms. Now, Orthodox theory then also went on to talk not only about movements of goods, but movements of capital. And the idea that they presented, and bourgeois economics is very consistent, is here you've got wealthy countries with plenty of capital, and therefore they're earning modest returns. Here you've got undeveloped countries with shortages of capital, and therefore you can get a higher return. And in addition, in the developed country, wages are high, and in the undeveloped country, wages are low. And so the idea is that it's of mutual interest for the people of both countries to allow the free market, because the advanced country capitalists will gain because they'll be getting a higher rate of return. And the undeveloped world will gain for an analogous reason, and that is they will have access to capital that they could not generate themselves. And in fact, in the advanced courses in economics, there's an attempt to show that there is an equilibrium in the long, long run, where the wages in the undeveloped country go up to eventually parity or near parity with the developed countries, and the rate of return gradually approaches equality also. Now, we know that this hasn't happened. Now, is this an aberration from a norm? Were there other factors? Or is there something wrong with the theory? Now, Orthodox economists obviously have not yet abandoned the theory. One of the reasons they haven't abandoned it is that the theory serves the interests of the wealthy class. Suppose, for example, that we're dealing with a developed country that, let's say, turns out machinery, and an undeveloped country that produces bananas. All right? Now, trade opens up. Free trade opens up. Now, what happens? The market for bananas expands. So there's even more production. The market for machinery expands. But what happens is a very differential impact. And that is, the country with the advanced technology gets all sorts of further thrust towards development, whereas the undeveloped country is mired in a low profit area. And they become dependent on the West, dependent on the developed countries. And so what the facts show, unlike the theory of mutual benefit, is that in point of fact, the advanced countries, and this has gone in waves, the U.S. did not originate this, you know, it was England and France and Holland and other countries. These countries have systematically pumped out a surplus from the undeveloped countries into the developed countries. And these undeveloped countries are furthermore tied to the cyclical rhythms of the advanced countries. In other words, the cycle, let's say, for some reason, goes up in America as a typical capitalist country. So their demand for imports from the third world also go up, particularly oil and minerals that are tied to industry. And there's good times all around. But capitalism is not an economy that is capable of sustained expansion. Not even bourgeois economists have been able to demonstrate that I'm wrong. They will cloak it somewhat differently. They won't present it as a defect, as I do. They will present it as that's the way it is, that if there's an expansion, there's waste, and that a moderate reduction weeds out the weak and strengthens the strong. And it's a process that one famous economist named Schumpeter called creative destruction that aids the thrust towards development over time. So what we see then is that the gap between the poor and the rich countries, instead of narrowing as orthodox theory would have it, has done just the reverse. Not only that, directly related to this latest stage in capitalist development, the undeveloped countries have experienced extraordinary inequality both within their country and between their country and the advanced countries. And in America also, we know that the polarization of income is at its highest level in American history, as far back as we have figures. It's now past the 1920s, and we know what the 1920s led to. Now, the reason for the cyclical nature of capitalism is a complicated subject, but I'll give it in brief. And that is, among the reasons is that it would be, in an unplanned system, it would be pure chance if the capital goods sector expanded at the same rate that the consumer goods sector. So what does that mean? That means that inevitably one gets out of phase with the other. One of the basic reasons for that is that under capitalism, there is a tendency, as one Marxist put it, to step on the accelerator as far as production is concerned in order to make a profit, but periodically to step on the brake as far as consumption is concerned. Why? Because the nature of capitalism is that the workers do not receive the full value that they produce. So inevitably, there is a lack of sufficient purchasing power to buy all the goods that are turned out. And so you can call it underconsumption or overinvestment, but So one of the basic reasons for the cyclical nature of capitalism is the imbalances that develop between the sectors. And this is more aggravated, I would hold, by the exploitative nature of the system, particularly along racial lines and in part gender lines and certainly ethnic lines. The tendency is for workers to generate more surplus value than they get back. And so at a critical point, the level of production cannot be maintained. And so that's a kind of basic set of facts about why, even though capitalism can have high and in periods extraordinary growth and generate lots of employment and create many marvels of technology, it is not capable of sustained development. Right? Now, what then follows in the world that we are living in, dominated by the global corporations, is an exaggeration of all the tendencies that existed before, supplemented by the increased role of the state. Now, you see, in the early models, the state was kind of neutral. It wasn't thought of as an active participant. And in fact, the earliest, what we call neoliberals today, they were just ordinary liberals back then, was to favor a hands-off by the state. You probably know this, but the terms liberal and conservative have been turned around. In the earliest period, the conservatives wanted a strong interventionist government because they were in control and they wanted the government to run things. The liberal wanted more freedom, more democracy. They wanted hands off by the government. Now, with the passage of time, capitalism moved from a competitive form to a more monopolistic form. And when that happened, the roles changed, and that is that the liberals that were always concerned with freedom and liberty and sensitive to repression, they began to realize that the monopolistic corporations were running the country. And so they began to look at the state as a possible means of controlling the corporations. And we began to pass antitrust acts, for example, in the late 1890s. And the conservatives, on the other hand, who had favored a strong state originally, moved in the other direction. Since they ran the country through the corporations, they no longer needed the state. But now what we are witnessing, I would hold, is that these conservatives are changing on the role of the state. They have begun to realize, and Bush is the medium for carrying it out, that the state can significantly aid the monopolistic sector. For example, the latest and most obvious is the intervention in Iraq. What it allows the U.S. to do is to penetrate their economy. And we have certainly done that. And look at the companies that have gotten the big contracts. War pays for those countries. Or when countries invade other regions, that opens the door to economic penetration by the major companies. The small companies don't really count except insofar as they get some subcontracting. So what this adds up to is that the government is a very key agent in globalization. It not only helps them penetrate other economies, but through its laws, particularly taxes and subsidies, it shifts the income in their favor. It makes it a more hospitable climate. And we have moved into an economy where the state has opened up all sorts of doors to big business. In fact, we can observe some of it in this area. Just think about what had to be done in terms of sports here, or the overtures that were made to Boeing, which didn't work, but nevertheless reveal that big business is in a position to enforce its wishes on society by pitting one sector against another sector, saying, if you don't lower taxes, if you don't give us a subsidy, if you don't build a stadium or a road or something like that, we'll take up our offer from city XYZ. And so you have a movement of Boeing from here to Chicago as one example. But it's going on all over. Now, it is said by the leaders of the countries in which the role of capital is the strongest, where globalization is strongest, that our role within globalization is to spread democracy, not only free markets, but it is said that democracy is a cousin of the free market. And that the planned state sector is the cousin of totalitarianism. And so America and England and other countries, even those that may differ with us on this particular war, they all represent the idea that they are bringing democracy to the world, especially the undeveloped countries. Now, this is based on an extraordinarily selective memory, because everybody is ahead of Alzheimer's remembers that the U.S. supported an extraordinary number of not only backward but reactionary governments. Governments where the leaders were certainly corrupt and would have made the prison scene in Iraq look like a busman's holiday in their treatment of their own people. But when there are popular movements that throw out or weaken the reactionaries, our country does have, or our ruling circles, have enough flexibility to sing a different tune. But it's always within a controlled framework. Just as there's a certain amount of significant difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. You know, we all know that. But there also is a fundamental similarity, and that is they both take the private property system as a given. One is stronger than the other at given times. It's like the tough guy, soft guy routine, where we go like a ping pong ball between one and the other, choosing the person that is least harmful, or what you perceive as least harmful to your needs. In some ways, you can think of them as arriving at the same spot, but the Democrats sort of grease the pole a little. And I think the same thing is going on with reaction, including resistance, to the forces of globalization. I do think that the protests in Seattle was a rude awakening. Now, I think, unfortunately, the consciousness of the American worker left much to be desired, because they tended to believe, or they intuitively understood, and correctly, that the rules were rigged against them, and that there was a kind of open sesame for capital. But they saw the enemy not as their own capitalists, but the workers in the third world. And that is a terrible blind spot. Now, the leaders of the American labor movement are, needless to say, hardly ready to join any radical movement. And but the workers were confused, and you could see they voted for Clinton, although Clinton was joining the Republican Party on this particular issue. So it's as if the workers do not understand that the issue is not free trade versus protected trade. It is what kind of system will we have in which there is a trade policy. And I think that is the key. And what I am suggesting is that we look at globalization not simply in terms of, as the title was, the solution or the problem. The point is that it's not globalization per se that is either the problem or the solution. It's capitalist globalization. Globalization could have a very different meaning. It could mean opening your doors to share your technology with other countries. That's fine. But when it is used with the goal, almost uni goal, of profit maximization, then it has deleterious effects on all sorts of levels. It greatly increases the polarization of income and wealth. And you probably have heard those figures that the 500 richest people in the world have as much assets in value as 41% of the world's population. Isn't that an incredible figure? Aggravating the wealth difference between the developed world and the undeveloped world. We have probably 2 billion people, according to the latest figures, that have insufficient diets. 2 billion. That's an extraordinary number. There are differences in disease rates and education. A quality of life is certainly extraordinarily different. Perhaps the most important factor, and this is where I respect the orientation of the Greens, and that is in this approach to maximization of wealth at all costs, we clearly are misutilizing the world's resources. We are making a sustainable future almost impossible. And that the reason I say that that may ultimately be the most important thing is, even if capitalism fell and the world was uninhabitable, it would be hardly a victory. And the Republican Party now is worse on that issue than alternative voices. But there is enough similarity to know that it's not the particular people that are behind this deterioration of the environment. It's a structure that seems to put in charge people, regardless of the two major parties, that aggravate the tendencies to confront nature with a greater and greater difficulty of dealing with waste. So on these issues, I think that a fundamental problem is that globalization is indicative of the greater and greater concentration of control over the nation, over the world. But at the same time, it is inadvertently sowing the seeds of its own destruction. And that is, it's whacking labor on the head in such a way that even some of the politically naive are beginning to see that there is no solution possible on a one-nation level. The reason being that capital will go to where its costs will be less and its profits greatest. But when capital gets there, it doesn't stay there. It keeps moving, leaving destruction in its wake. Well, workers that are not necessarily people of the left, after they have been left, after they have lost some of their retirement, after they begin to see the precariousness of their life in this system, some of them are beginning to question whether they have to look for alternatives. I'm not saying this is happening tomorrow, but if rationality has any basis to action, and I have to believe that even in a world where we're smothered with advertising that is designed to do the thinking for us, at some point there is some insight, some intellectual integrity, and at some point people begin to look reality in the face, even if it means discarding some old illusions. This woman that's protesting over the death of her son hits me as somebody like that. Somebody probably had few, if any, radical thoughts in her head. Probably was patriotic. Hadn't heard of the famous literary line that patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels. She probably believed all the propaganda she was getting. But confronted with the loss of a son, she had the integrity, the strength, the inner strength, to look at herself, to think it through, and begin to question the wisdom. Now, so far, it's only the wisdom as regards a particular foreign policy. Whether it will extend elsewhere, we don't know. There are many people that have acknowledged most of what I've said who are saying, but there's no other game in town. You know, for example, one person whose books you should read, I found them very interesting, although I end up disagreeing with them, are David Corton. Corton would agree with much of what I've said about capitalism. But he juxtaposes to capitalism which he says is dominated by global corporations seeking their own gain. He juxtaposes to that a market society that he believes is the best choice we have, particularly if it's locally centered. And so what he wants is a return from monopoly capital to an earlier stage of local competitive capital. And there are many people, individuals, who are doing that. In this area, we have people that have turned to small farming, small stores. That's no issue for people on the left. But with Corton, he sees that as the best of all possible worlds. In other words, he's against monopoly capitalism and socialism, where he defines the Russian form of socialism as the only form. And so I think where he ends up is a kind of reformism. And he's extraordinarily sensitive to many of the actions of the corporations. He knows more about it than anybody I know, including me. He's very sensitive to the need for a more caring, more equitable system. But he ends up favoring an earlier competitive form of capitalism that is no longer, in my opinion, a viable solution. And so what is a viable solution? How do you have freedom? How do you make use of globalization? And there obviously are many people coming up with different solutions. Mine is a minority view, it is that we need a highly different form of socialism than we have had so far. I am as little in favor of the old Soviet-type systems as I am of our current capitalist systems. To me, they're both anti-life. I think that international markets demand international control, international planning, and that the only way in which international capital can be checked, confronted, is by international labor. As I mentioned earlier, I don't believe that there is a solution on an individual level. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't struggle on an individual country level. After all, we're citizens of America and not of Estonia. Part of the political struggle has to originate on the national level, both local, state, and national. We have to struggle where we are. But I believe that ultimately it is the form of ownership that sets the tone of a society, and that ours is a society based on private property, the pursuit and of maximizing private property, and the devil take the hindmost. It is the orientation, it is the value system that is inculcated from a very early age, and it is very difficult to get into a frame, a mindset of saying, we make history. We don't make it under conditions of our own choosing, but we have to act as if we have the possibility of changing this. There was an old Italian socialist died in Mussolini's jails, in fact, that drew a distinction between what he called pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. In other words, even if your mind tells you our chances of success are near zilch, that you have to act as if you can change things, because if you don't, where are you? You're right at the starting line. And so I think that what we need is to begin to challenge a system that has deformed society, that has structured a world around greed rather than cooperation, around racism rather than race-free, of sexism, of ethnocentrism, and replace it with a society in which human beings, for the first time, will have control over their destiny and be able to make the next progressive change of society, namely from capitalism to socialism. Thank you.